Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. If you haven't already seen it, there's an amazing series airing on National Geographic Channel right now. It's called Continent 7, Antarctica. And I'm lucky enough to have one of the scientists featured on the show joining us today. So let me dive straight in here and introduce him. He's Dr. Ari S. Friedlander. He's a marine ecologist and an associate professor at Oregon State University's Marine Mammal Institute. His research interests are in using tag technology to study the underwater behavior of marine mammals. And he's been working in Antarctica since 1997. He's made more than 25 trips to the seventh continent. And during that time, he's developed a long-term ecological research program that has led to many important discoveries about whales in Antarctica. Let's find out more. Dr. Ari Friedlander, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I was totally glued to this series. I missed it on television, but of course, National Geographic puts their shows out on many platforms. And so I watched a lot of it on the internet, on the National Geographic channel, and was totally glued to it. So very excited to have you here with us. I want to just start with a quote that you from you. It says, "I try to describe Antarctica. It's really difficult to describe it without feeling it. It's a place that's uncomfortable. It's not a place that you feel at home. It's really the most wild and natural place I've been, because I think down here you recognize very quickly that this is a place and an environment where people shouldn't be." So I'm wondering, is this the kind of work that you always dreamed of doing? Did this evolve as you got your education and work? How did you come to be doing what you're doing?
Good question. You know, I probably would blame my parents for a lot of that. I was exposed to science at a really early age, and I grew up on the coast in Connecticut. And, you know, interestingly, the history of men and whales, or humans and whales, has a really long relationship in New England with commercial and Yankee whaling a couple hundred years ago. And then, in fact, the first person to step foot on the Antarctic continent was a person down there hunting seals named Nathaniel Palmer. So even though I probably wasn't aware of it at the time, I grew up probably in the shadow of both whaling and the Antarctic. And then as my academic interests grew into marine mammals and understanding their behavior and how they relate to their environment, the opportunity to work in Antarctica came up, and I jumped at it and really had no idea where it would take me, and have been very fortunate to work with good people and have great colleagues and get to do some really amazing research in a place that has become very, very special to me.
Yeah. So what does a typical year look like for you? You spend so much time at the university in Oregon and then so much time in Antarctica. I mean, how does that work?
You know, so we work off of research grants, and the National Science Foundation in the United States is one of the agencies that supports Antarctic research. And so we have grants that support.
Okay.
We work with other grants in different parts of the world. So the Antarctic season for me and my team is from about January 1st through the end of April. And then we do a lot of work in the Northern Hemisphere around California or the Pacific Northwest or the East Coast of the U.S. And that generally will be in our summertime. And then the spring and fall are when we work with students and analyze our results and write up papers and catch our breath or defrost if we've been away for a while.
Right. You can defrost, yes. A deep defrost. It sounds as though you're on a cell phone, Ari, right?
Yeah,
I just want to let our listeners know that, because you did cut out for a little tiny blip there. So if that happens, we could only reach Ari on a cell phone. So bear with us, because he's got lots of great information here to share with us. Let's talk about the Antarctic itself and what makes that so special. I'm going to just talk about one of my favorite scenes in the whole series that I've seen to date. and it actually, it, you're in it. But it's when you're out looking for minke whales. This is one of my favorite scenes in the whole series that I've seen to date. And you're standing in a tiny little inflatable boat. You've left the safety of your ship in search of minke whales because you want to tag them. And that I think, is where you make the comment that this is a place where people just shouldn't be. So tell us what that's like, being out there on the water, this tiny little boat. All you can see is water and ice. And at one point you cut the engine because you said your most favorite time there is when it's totally silent of human sound.
Yeah, that's like you read before, it's a difficult thing to describe, but it puts you into the place in that part of the world where you realize that this is a place where these animals are absolutely adapted for and what they are evolved to succeed in. And we as people, we've got to go through a lot just to make it back at the end of the day. And it's true wilderness. It's absolutely unfettered, and it's hostile. And the thing that I think we forget about sometimes is we get very kind of tunnel vision when we're doing our research. You've got to be focused on the animals to deploy a tag or to collect a biopsy sample. And sometimes we forget to look around, I think. And it was one of those times where it was appropriate to just kind of cut the engine and listen for those animals because we couldn't see them because it was blowing snow.
Right.
And it gives you that time to pause and just say, you know what, look, we're in a pretty unique place. We should really appreciate this for what it is and for the opportunities that we have.
Mm. Yeah, if I wasn't for the fact that I was toasty warm, I would have felt I was there. It was a great scene. So just to put this in perspective for listeners, Antarctica is the coldest, driest, windiest continent on the planet. They describe it as 5.4 million square miles of desert. I didn't realize how windy it was there.
You know, the climate and the weather in the Antarctic can vary quite a bit depending on where you are. So where we work around the Antarctic Peninsula, south of South America, that environment is very heavily influenced by weather conditions that come from the ocean, from the west. The continent of Antarctica, where the South Pole is and where McMurdo Station is and some of these other big ice sheets are, there's almost its own atmospheric circulation that guides the weather there. And that's where you get a lot of the very strong winds and the big storms. But the peninsula is a much more wet, maritime kind of environment.
Mm, right. Do you know how many people are out there? Because the only people who are out there are researchers, and there's countries from all over the world. New Zealand had quite a heavy force there.
Yeah, you know, I don't know the exact number, but I think there's something around 70 bases around the Antarctic. Palmer Station, which is the United States Antarctic Program's base on the peninsula, only has 45 people at it when it's at full capacity. And most of the bases are in probably the 50 to 100 people that can be there at a time. McMurdo Station is the outlier, where there's, I think, over 1,000 people there during the summertime. But it's a combination of both scientists as well as all of the support people. And one of the things that I think the show does a really nice job of doing is making you realize that, well, a scientist, you know, we can't take care of ourselves, to be honest. And in a place like the Antarctic, you need the logistic support of people who understand machinery, understand the environment, and can keep us safe and protect us from the elements as well.
Yes. Yeah. Very difficult situation. I can't even begin to imagine. One, actually more than one, there were several people on the series who said, sometimes I wonder why I do this. It's very, very taxing on the body. And one guy even went as far to say that the body deteriorates every time he goes out there. Do you feel that yourself?
You know, when we do our work and we're on a ship for 2 or 3 months at a time, there's a lot of stressors for sure. You know, you feel confined. You're with the same people every day for a long period of time. And it's like that on a ship almost anywhere in the world. But
right.
The fact that it's hard to go outside, you can't walk around. It makes routine pretty difficult. And we really relish the times when we can get away, when we can, you know, maybe take a day off and go for a hike or visit another station and see new faces. So it's difficult both sort of emotionally as well as physically.
I would imagine. Do you have family, Ari?
I don't have children. I've got a family and a wonderful group of friends and colleagues. And the ships, I'd say in the last 10 years, have upgraded our ability to communicate with home. And we have email on the ship, and there are satellite phones so that we can call home and keep in touch with people. And it's made a huge difference, I think, for morale, for people to be able to stay connected to their families and loved ones.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm talking with Dr. Ari Friedlander. He is one of the many scientists featured in season one of the first ever global long-form documentary series filmed in Antarctica. It's called Continent 7. It's on National Geographic Channel on Tuesday nights. So it will be on tomorrow night, Tuesday night, 10, 9 Central. I want to talk specifically now, Ari, about some of the work that you're doing, because you've been doing this for 25 years, established a very well-known program, and I here have made some amazing discoveries about whales. So what is the top thing that's thrilled you the most during your research?
Well, in the time that I've been working down there, we've been, myself and lots of other people in our field, have been developing new technology to study the underwater behavior of these animals. We see them at the surface for maybe 5% of the time, and what they're doing underwater is really where they make a living. And so to me, understanding how these animals behave, how they feed, how they move around, how they communicate, and just sort of the daily life of a whale in the Antarctic to me is really a unique question that we're trying to answer. And so over time, we've learned about how these animals behave at different times of the year, the types of features of the environment that they aggregate around and that they need. And that gives us the understanding to be able to predict or understand the effects of climate change and global warming on these animals. Because as an animal at the poles, you're so supremely adapted for that environment because it's so harsh and intolerant that if things change, you know, either direction quickly, the ability of those animals to respond to change is quite limited. And so understanding the threats and the risks to these animals because of what we do is sort of the implication of understanding how these animals survive.
Right. How easy is it? I mean, how many days are you out there looking to tag whales? Because I saw in the video that the last time out you tagged a 66,000-pound humpback. But then you're out right. Looking for minkies, and they're a lot harder. They're a little shyer, I guess.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So humpbacks are a species we work with around the world, and they're very tractable for us. They make good volunteers, we like to say, because they spend a bit more time at the surface. They can be very curious. If we're down there for a month and we have 30 days to do our work, we probably average about one tag deployment on a humpback whale every day. For minke whales, we put our first tag on a minke whale in February of 2013. And before that time, nobody had ever measured the behavior of a minke whale with a tag.
Wow.
And so it's only been in the last couple of years that we've, sorry for the pun, we've kind of broken the ice on studying some
right.
of these animals.
Right. So what have you learned during those 2 years about minkes?
The things that we've learned about minkes is that they have this extraordinary affinity for sea ice and for living in that habitat. And this is the portion of the ocean that freezes every year and creates that big round shape around the Antarctic continent, and then it retreats in the summertime. And the sea ice is critical for minkes for two reasons. One is because minke whales are small enough that they actually get preyed on by killer whales, and they can basically hide in the sea ice. The other thing is that they're small enough that they can feed and maneuver in and around the sea ice like other whales can't. So it's a habitat that only the minke whales can really take advantage of. And in the place that we work in the Antarctic Peninsula, the amount of sea ice cover that is available every year is diminishing very, very quickly. So the habitat that's available for minke whales is decreasing dramatically in this part of the world. Mm. And on the flip side of that, it makes it a very good place for something like a humpback whale that doesn't tolerate sea ice very well and likes open water. So we're kind of documenting this shift in the species that are able to survive and cope in this part of the Antarctic due directly to climate change.
Right. Well, let's talk about climate change. It's hard to believe that there are still people out there who believe climate change is a hoax, given all the science that we've had laid at our feet and is proven over and over and over again. What do you say to people who don't buy it?
You know, there's a couple of things. I think the first thing is that, you know, as a scientist, I believe facts and I believe science, and climate change is a fact. It's based in science, and people who have other opinions, literally, it's that. It's an opinion. It's not based in fact. And so I would ask people who don't believe in it where the evidence is to support that and show them a lot of evidence or compelling evidence to the contrary. I've gone down to the Antarctic on tour ships several times, and one of the best things that I think you can do is to engage people who have different kinds of opinions and views and educate and show them and demonstrate what some of those things look like. And I feel like just having that opportunity to talk to somebody, understand their opinion, and try and sway them to believe fact is what we should be doing.
Mm. You obviously talk with a lot of people, you know, in your various roles as a researcher, scientist, and university professor. What do you find people are most surprised about when you're talking with them about Antarctica?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think people are probably most surprised. That's a really good question. I think they're probably most surprised by how interactive some of the animals are that we work with. In some of the clips that you see on the show, the humpback whales will literally come over to us and check us out and are very curious about us. And if you've ever gone to a penguin colony, they do the same thing. They'll walk right up to you and take a look at you and, you know, maybe peck at your shoelaces. And the animals down there have no reason to fear humans because they've evolved in a landscape that doesn't include us as a threat. And so you get to see wildlife behaving in a way that is very different from what you might see somewhere else in the world.
Mm. I've been on a couple of eco tours over the years. One of them was with the gray whales birthing in the birthing lagoons.
Yep.
Down in Mexico. I also went up to Churchill to see the polar bears in the wild there. What are your views on ecotourism? There's been a lot of debate about it, especially in Antarctica.
Mm-hmm. You know, I believe in it. I believe it's a good thing. I think it can be managed and done in a responsible and a respectful way. And we do a lot of work with the tour industry in the Antarctic. I think if I were to do my science in a vacuum and limit the opportunities to talk to people about the science and what we believe in and what we're finding, then I, as a scientist, am not doing my job, you know, as a communicator, as an educator. And so I think the tourism industry, especially in the Antarctic, is built around a lot of very sound principles of trying to minimize the impact of people in the Antarctic. And I take it as an opportunity to educate people, to go down to do my science, to show people what we're doing, and give them the absolute, you know, kind of firsthand knowledge, the hot off the presses kind of thing. And then I like to implore people and say, you know what, look, you've come down here, you've experienced this, you're an ambassador now, you know, you've got a responsibility to communicate the things about this place that make it special to your friends and to your friends' friends. And I think Antarctica is a place that touches you in a very emotional way when you're down there. And I think it gets people kind of fired up to want to have a bigger role in some of the causes like climate change and global warming.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you hit it on the head when you said if it's responsibly managed, that's the key thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the tourism industry in the Antarctic worked very hard to do that, and it self-regulates itself very nicely. And a lot of companies are starting to support science more as well. And I think that's a really wonderful thing to be able to promote, is that it's not just to simply go down and take from the experience of the Antarctic, but you're learning. I put people to work when I'm on the tourist trips with them. You know, I'll have them look for whales for me, and I'll get a few interns, you know, on the ship, and they'll be up in the morning helping me find whales, and it can be a really fun experience for people.
Oh, love it, love it. So what do you hope people will take away from this fabulous National Geographic series? It really, I think I said at the top of the hour, it's one of the best series I've seen in a long time. What do you hope people will take away from it?
Well, you know, a couple of things. The first is, I think the National Geographic Society is one of those institutions in the world that we need to really appreciate. They put their money where their mouth is and say, you know what, we want to show this place and we want to show the people who are doing the work down there. And I think by humanizing the research and not making it just natural history, I think people get a really different appreciation for that kind of science. And I want people to understand that the people who are down there doing the science are also passionate about it. You know, I'm as much an advocate for this place and for wildlife and for being responsible as anything. And I hope that this show kind of shows that we do what we love. It might be a difficult place, but we all absolutely love what we do. And the sacrifices that we make to do the work are because we believe in it so much and because we have a passion to learn and to communicate that kind of thing.
Right. Awesome. Well, that definitely comes across during the show. Dr. Ari Friedlander, thank you so much for being with us today. Where can listeners find out more about you? It's your website is arifriedlander.com, right?
That's a website that has one of the photographic books that I published. But if folks are interested in our research, the Marine Mammal Institute at Oregon State University is where a lot of our research projects are shown, and you can learn a lot about that. And also on the National Geographic Channel, there's some great clips with links to our research and other things that we've done.
Okay, great. And I'll tell listeners more about the show when we come back. We're going to take a very quick break. My guest there, Dr. Ari Friedlander. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And please stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And then I'm there with salt.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
It's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just gonna keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair airs live every Monday at noon. And now you can also catch the show during drive time at 6 a.m. every Friday. Hear from New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, cutting-edge health and wellness professionals, award-winning journalists, filmmakers, explorers, and adventurers. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Mondays at noon Pacific time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, bringing you topics ranging from meditation to conservation, business and careers to health and wealth.
Exploring new territory every day. This is Alternative Talk 1150.
All And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we just had the pleasure of having Dr. Ari Friedlander join us. He's an associate professor at University of Oregon and spent the past 25 years going backwards and forwards to Antarctica doing his research studies out there. Amazing, amazing work that he's doing. And he's part of the National Geographic Channel series, which is, I believe, one of the, if not the first of its kind. It's a long-form documentary filmed in Antarctica. It's called Continent 7 Antarctica. It premiered in November on National Geographic Channel, but it's still airing. I have another show coming up tomorrow, Tuesday. But I didn't catch any of the shows on air. You can catch them on the internet. National Geographic always provides multiple platforms for you to watch on. You can usually get them on demand on your from your service provider, your TV service provider. I watch them on the internet. As I said, I just jumped on National Geographic Channel Antarctica, and I watched all of the series. And it really, as you expect from National Geographic, it is superbly filmed. And you really see the great work that people are doing out there. And they make a lot of sacrifices out there. You know, we complain a bit when it rains here. And there were people who got stranded in the snow for many days. There was one really interesting scene with two New Zealand or a New Zealand doctor who went to visit a camp that hadn't been touched since 1911. It was when Scott was out down there. And, of course, his team went out. They got trapped in the storm for several days, and they all froze to death. And nobody had been back to this camp, his base camp, since. And so you could see their boots were lined up, their hats were on the shelves. They documented everything with this new technology that takes thousands and thousands of frames of footage, and they have to piece it all together. It's really quite an amazing series, very, very interesting. And again, it's called Continent 7 Antarctica, Tuesdays at 10, 9 Central. All right. So Eric and I are going to have a little chat here because we never get time to talk, do we, Eric?
That's true. We're kind of rushing in, rushing out, doing the show. And we spend this hour every week together, which I'm very thankful for, of course. But yeah, as far as in-depth conversation, we rarely get that time, unfortunately.
So anyway, I thought we'd take the last part of the show today to have a little chat. And I just wanted to ask you what you're doing for the holidays.
Well, for Christmas, I'll be in my new home celebrating Christmas for the first time in the new house, which is very nice. I have a working fireplace now, so I'm so excited to burn that Yule log, and going to have some guests over, family, friends, and just have a nice Christmas dinner and
do
the kind of traditional thing.
Yeah, because you often go away, don't you? So it'll be nice to be at home this year.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going away.
Where are you headed?
I'm actually going to Long Beach and staying there for a couple of days with friends. And then I'm going to head up the coast. Every year I do a retreat where I go off by myself. And this year I'm kind of having to split it up into two little trips. So I thought I'd tag an extra two or three days onto my Christmas, because, you know, I do Christmas Day and Boxing Day.
Of course, because you're British.
Okay, nobody can mess with my Boxing Day. It's actually my favorite day, Boxing Day. It's all about eating the leftovers and relaxing and, you know, just relaxing.
So it's not about hanging out with Mike Tyson?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't think that would be much fun.
That's a different Boxing Day.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I'm just going to take take two or three days. I'm going to tag them onto my Christmas vacation and then just take off at the coast by myself.
And, you know, we often hear about Boxing Day, by the way, if you don't mind. In America, we hear that term, Boxing Day. And I know it's big in Canada, it's big in the UK, but I'm not sure exactly what it is or what are the traditions surrounding Boxing Day, at least in the UK.
When I grew up, I was told, because my mother actually...
Because it's the day after Christmas,
It's the day after Christmas. 26th. It's the 26th, right. And it is a holiday. I was most distraught when I came to America and realized, what, I only get one day off for Christmas? Are you kidding me? But I put it down as my religious holiday, right, even though it's not a religious holiday. But I've heard many different stories. But I grew up, I was told by my grandparents and great-grandparents that it was the day when people actually exchanged gifts.
Oh,
they,
okay.
They exchanged gift boxes. And that Christmas Day originally, traditionally, was more about the religious, spiritual side of things and, you know, in giving thanks for whatever. I didn't grow up in a religious household, so we certainly do the traditional thing and change, you know, exchange gifts on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
But I also I've heard a lot of different things, but that to me, I think, is the most reasonable.
That makes sense. I've also heard that Boxing Day was the day that people gave to the poor. They had boxes in the churches for donations, and
yeah,
then they would, and that would be the boxes in the Boxing Day. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but that's one of the things that I've heard. But it is interesting to have that cultural difference between, you know, Britain and America. Because, you know, we, as I say, we hear about it a lot, Boxing Day, but I don't think most Americans have a grasp on what it's all about. But it's just extending that Christmas fun, right?
Yeah, I think we should adopt it here. I'm going to make a petition here. We adopt it here because look at how much work most people put into Christmas.
Right.
Right. And there's a lot of pressure on Christmas Day for some people. I don't put that kind of pressure on myself anymore, but I used to, certainly when I was younger. You want everything to be perfect and everything, you know, the cloth napkins have to be perfect and match this and match that. There's so much pressure put on people, and they don't always enjoy that Christmas Day.
That's true.
And then Boxing Day is the day where you just relax and kick back.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very good. And it's actually my sister's birthday, so we've always called it Christymas. Her name is Christy. So in our family, Boxing Day is Christymas.
Christymas.
Yeah.
And I love it.
She celebrates her birthday that day, and all the gifts go to her that day. So.
Well, talking about cultural changes, I looked up a couple of things here to see what some traditions were around the world, and there were some quite interesting ones. I'm gonna read this one to you and see if you can guess where this takes place, what country this takes place in. Okay. Put you on the spot here.
I think there's a new Christmas tradition.
I have to make sure I don't say the name of the country. Hold on one second. Okay, there's a country. There's a place. And they have a tradition of adding spider webs to the Christmas trees, which may seem odd, but it's based on an old folk tale in which a poor mother and her children had no decorations for their Christmas tree. Hearing their cries, spiders decorated their tree overnight, and upon waking, the widow and her children saw the morning light dancing across these webs that had been built on their tree. And from that day forward, the widow never felt poor. Instead, she was always grateful for the wonderful gifts she's already got in life. And it's believed today that the webs will bring good fortune and luck for the upcoming year. That's a nice story, right?
Yeah, I like that. And this is definitely how Spider-Man celebrates as well. Peter Parker puts up the tree. You know it's covered in webs.
So do you know, do you have any kind of guess where that?
Well, being American, I think of spider webs as being kind of spooky and Halloween-y, so I'm going Transylvania on this one. Am I right?
Ukraine,
okay.
Not bad. Okay, and there's another one here, and I like this too because I try to stop working Christmas Eve, as soon as possible, midday, right, if I have to work on Christmas Eve. But in this country, all work ceases on the afternoon of Christmas Eve, and the family put on their finery for this occasion. They get together to make up decorations for the Christmas tree. For the superstitious, all the brooms in the house are hidden. These people long ago believed that witches and mischievous spirits come out on Christmas Eve and would steal their brooms for riding. And Nissi, a little gnome who guards all the farm animals, is another superstition. But let's look at the broom one. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's great. It almost, again, sounds kind of Halloween stuff getting mashed up with Christmas here. Kind of like the Nightmare Before Christmas. I don't know if you've seen that film, but that's a fun one. Yeah, what country? That sounds kind of Germanic to me, so I'm going to say Germany.
Well, Norwegian.
So close.
Scandinavian.
Really, but, yeah.
And then the Nissi, the little gnome, he guards all the farm animals in another superstition, also Norwegian. And Norwegian children believe if they don't place a bowl of special porridge for Nissi, he will play tricks on them. So, yes, it does sound as though Halloween got a little mixed up with Christmas.
Right. You know, there are a few countries that have that kind of idea of a mischievous elf or a mischievous Santa's helper that kind of plays tricks on people or, you know, punishes bad kids like Krampus, for instance. So it's interesting that we never evolved that kind of mythology in this country.
Yeah. Well, Italy is another one, but it's on January 5th, and they wait, children await the arrival of Befana. I don't know how to say that. It's B-E-F-A-N-A, Befana, an old and ugly but friendly witch who will bring them toys and delicious sweets.
So the witch brings treats and sweets. I like
treats
it.
Treats and sweets.
Again, it's like Halloween mashed up. So,
And I've got one more here before we go to break. So, and this one is, I'll have to say it's Iceland because I'm going to ask you, you've been to Iceland and...
I have, yeah. That was really fun. Luckily, I went in the summer, so I didn't get to witness the very chilly Christmas traditions. But they've got quite a few interesting ones over there.
Such as?
Well, I was going to mention they have a tradition called Jólabókaflóð, and I'm sure I totally mispronounced that. But that's for Christmas book flood, and books are one of the biggest gifts in Iceland at Christmas. That's the top gift. And apparently they publish more books per capita than any country in the world, which is surprising since, you know, it's the small country. But five titles published for every 1,000 Icelanders. And and they sell the majority of them between September and November because people are buying them for Christmas gifts for folks. And it's been a big thing for a long time to give out those books every year for Christmas.
I'm going to Iceland in April. I didn't tell you.
Oh, you did. Fantastic.
I'm going in April.
You're going to have a great time.
Yeah, I'm going to a writer's retreat, and then I'm going to do some touristy stuff. You know, there's that place where the two tectonic plates meet between the two different continents, and you can go scuba diving there. I want to go there.
Nice.
Just my luck, the tectonic Very plates nice. Will move and crush me.
No, that'll never happen.
So... But anyway, looking at unique holiday traditions in Iceland, Christmas starts at 6 p.m. on Christmas Eve, December 24th, and the festivities last until the 13th day, which is the 12th night, which falls on January the 6th. And I know in our household, we kind of did the 12th night thing because our Christmas lights always had to come back down by the 12th night. My mother said it was bad luck to leave them up longer than that. So on the night before December 12th, it's customary for Icelandic children to put one of their shoes in the window, and that shoe stays on the windowsill until Christmas. And the children hope that the Yule lads who come into town from the mountains one by one on the nights leading up to Christmas will leave a little something for them in the shoe. But only, of course, well-behaved children earn gifts. And those who don't or who are not well-behaved, guess what they find in their shoe?
Rocks?
Near enough, a potato.
A potato. That's a decent consolation prize, actually. You can do a lot of good things with a potato.
And then I had one more here, which I thought was, this was really interesting. And this is in, we'll see if you can guess where they do this. Christmas Mass is a common tradition around the globe. Mm-hmm. In this particular place, in this city, in this country, churchgoers arrive on roller skates. It's kind of fun. I wonder if there's an age limit on that. I can't imagine everybody would turn up on roller skates. But apparently the city cuts off all vehicle access to the city before eight a.m., and that allows the entire city to safely make their commute on skates to the church for Mass.
Wow. What and country is really into skating?
Or that, really into Mass. I mean, it starts, you know.
Boy, I've never heard of that. When I think of Christmas Mass, I automatically think of Rome, where the Vatican is. So I'm going to say Rome, although that's probably not true. But
it's Caracas, Venezuela.
Venezuela.
Yeah.
Interesting. Fantastic.
Yeah. And then we'll just make this the last one here, because there's a delicacy here, which I'm sure you would love to try. So turkey is the traditional meal, but the locals dine on delicacies of deep fried caterpillars and emperor moths. Where do you think that would be? and remind me not to go there for Christmas because I don't want to offend anyone.
Yeah, some of these holiday traditions, I was thinking I should jot that down, maybe try that myself. But
not that
this one. They keep the caterpillars. I'm thinking somewhere in South America, Bolivia.
Oh, well, you got the South A right. It's South Africa.
Oh, okay.
All right, that's our little holiday unique things going on around the world right now. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got some books to share with you as last-minute holiday ideas, or maybe you just want to get yourself a treat. I'm sure some of you have got gift vouchers out there coming your way. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair airs live every Monday at noon. And now you can also catch the show during drive time at 6 a.m. every Friday. Hear from New York Times bestselling authors, innovative business leaders, cutting-edge health and wellness professionals, award-winning journalists, filmmakers, explorers, and adventurers. Tune in to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Mondays at noon Pacific time and Fridays at 6 a.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicky St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicky partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicky today. Email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicky and her work at VickySt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Ananda Institute of Living Yoga, we cover the world of animals. This week, it's Christmas Day and an encore presentation. Tune in to hear our official Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah edition with the Jingle Cats and Dogs and Jude and Paul Ponton from Whispering Dragon. We sing our favorite animal version Christmas carols, and Jude and Paul work their harmonic and energy-shifting magic with our callers. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Talk radio with a purpose. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we're having a special little holiday segment here, Eric and I, here in the studio. Eric Ryder, of course, who keeps us live every week. Thank you so much, Eric.
My pleasure.
So I wanted to just, in this last few minutes we have here, look at some books, additional books. You know, we cover a lot of books on the show. We don't just talk with authors, but we talk with a lot of people who do write books. And I know a lot of our listeners are always emailing me, what do you recommend for this and that? So I pulled off a list from TED Talks, from TED.com, because I thought, you know, they kind of cover some of the same kind of topics that we're interested in, and run a wide gamut of subjects and topics. So I wanted to start with this one because this is actually one of my favorite books of this year. I read it earlier this year when I was in a creative funk, and I was at the bookstore looking for inspiration, and I came across Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic book. It's called Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. I did not like her Eat, Pray, Love book. I think I probably said that before. I didn't even get past page 100 in it. I just couldn't get into it at all. I couldn't put this one down. It really is a look at her journey and things she's learned over the years. And if you've ever heard her speak on TED Talks, she has a great resonance about her, and I could hear her voice very strongly in this book. And so throughout the book, she reminds you constantly that if you take creativity off its precious pedestal and take all that fear away, and you just keep working on something, magic does happen. So that's why that's one of my favorite books of this year. And again, it's Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, Elizabeth Gilbert. Now, a lot of listeners over the years have asked for recommendations on picture books and graphic novels. And I know, Eric, you have a favorite. You have a couple there, maybe.
Yeah, I was just going to personally recommend Daniel Clowes' latest book called Patience, which was a very interesting. His work is always interesting, but this one was more. Typically, his books are a little bit shorter. He's famous for having written Ghost World and a lot of really cool graphic novels. But this one was a little more in depth than he normally does, which I, as a fan of his, found great. And the subject matter, I don't want to give too much away, but talks about time travel and stuff. So it's kind of science fiction-y, but in a way that's a totally different approach than I've ever seen before. So, and his artwork is always very cool. So
what, who would you say, what kind of audience would you say would read his book?
Anybody into kind of, you know, quirky, different storytelling, I think would like it. Yeah. Regardless of whether you normally get into graphic novels or not. I think his work kind of stands alone from other artists out there.
Name again and author?
Dan Clowes.
Dan Clowes. Okay. Yeah. And one more off that list?
Let's talk about Trashed by Durf Backderf, which is a great name, Durf Backderf. And this was recommended by Dave Issay. He says, I spotted this graphic novel on a shelf at my favorite indie bookstore, and it blew me away. A fascinating and gritty autobiographical account of working on a sanitation truck in a small town. Overflows with great characters and moments, including a few memorable ones involving maggot-infested trash cans. It's the perfect gift. That does actually sound pretty interesting.
It does.
I'll check that out.
Book again and name.
Again, it's called Trashed by Derf Backderf.
I just wanted to hear you say that name. All right, let's look at one from Arts and Architecture. And I love the title of this, The Singing Neanderthals, The Origins of Music, Language, Mind, and Body. And they say this is a brilliant read for anyone who's passionately connected to music. It brings together psychology, evolutionary biology, neuroscience, archaeology, and more to uncover just how deeply music is embedded in our species. And that, again, is The Singing Neanderthals, The Origins of Music, Language, Mind, and Body. And this one I pulled from the biography section, biography and memoir. It's called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan. And the person who recommended this, Anders Fjellberg, said, sometimes I just want to read a book that makes me want to quit my job and travel the world to look for adventures. That is this kind of book, or this is that kind of book, excuse me. It's framed in his lifelong addiction to surfing. And Finnegan writes raw and beautifully about growing up in Hawaii, coming of age, exploring the world in search of waves and purpose, and later the complex question of balancing family, work, and hours spent doing what you love most. So it's a fairly common struggle there. But he says this is a great read and the book that makes you want to escape. It's called Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan. Do you have one more there, Eric?
Yeah, in the graphic novels, Batman Year One by Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli. It's a great novel about urban crime that just happens to have Batman in it, is what Chip Kidd says. And if you're a Batman fan and you like the darker, edgier version of Batman, then I think Batman Year One probably be a good pick.
I was at the park with my dog yesterday and I saw this great, but you know, one of those F-450 trucks, whatever they are, those big, big, you know, I am a man kind of trucks. So I'm walking past it. It's brand new. It's all shiny. Somebody obviously loves this truck so much. And they've got Batman stickers all over the back. And so I'm thinking, does somebody think that's his Batmobile? And then this guy comes up and he's about 90, cutest little guy. And he goes, I saw you admiring my Batmobile.
There you go.
It's like, you know, whatever makes you happy.
That's right. You be you, Batman guy.
You be you, yeah. Well, since my first guest today was a scientist, Dr. Ari Friedlander, I thought we'd look at a couple of science books here. This sounds really interesting. It was recommended by Bill Gross. He says, this book really showed me the amazing pathways that led to innovations that make our lives work today. The stories are told almost like a dramatic mystery to make the history come to life with excitement and aha moments. And that is called How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World by Stephen Johnson. And for those who are interested in plants, I'm told this book changes the way you look at the world. This book, it's the book that asks, are plants intelligent? This is one of them. It's called Brilliant Green, The Surprising History and Science of Plant Intelligence by Stefano Manciusco. Okay, I think that's about all we've got time for there, but I've got loads more. If you're stuck, give me a call at info at 800-495-7617. Happy to supply the list to you at any time. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Eric, and I wish you all the great holidays and all that good stuff because it's the last time we'll see you. And I'll see you until next year because I'm taking a little break over the holiday. You also are taking a little break over the holiday. And I hope our listeners are too. And if you're not taking a break, if you don't celebrate the holidays, I at least hope you get some quality downtime. And because looking out there at the weather right now, it's not that thrilling.
It's great to be inside and read a book on a day like today.
It's great to be inside and read a book. And we've got, oh gosh, I don't know how many hundreds of podcasts, like 400 or 500 podcasts.
That's right.
You can also catch up on a couple of podcasts there. So that's it then for today. We have a great lineup coming for you next week. We're going to kick off with somebody who I think you'll find very interesting, January 2nd. So don't miss that show. And you can find me at 800-495-7617. You can also find me at info@conversationslive.net. If you have any questions or feedback on today's show, that's where you can find us, info@conversationslive.net. And you can also find us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. Happy holidays, everyone. Merry Christmas. Be safe. Be happy.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.